On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Princeton philosopher Harry Frankfurt made a sensation not long ago with a slim but feisty little book entitled On BS, On Bull, or actually the pungent long form of that phrase. We're drowning in BS, said the august philosopher, and the bull slingers are actually worse than liars because they don't even care about the difference between truth and lies. Then he started thinking, does society care anymore? We'd better, Harry Frankfurt is back to say in his new book On Truth. In an age of truthiness and spin, this philosopher wants you to know that the truth still matters. In fact, he says, civilization hinges on it. Up next, On Point, Harry Frankfurt wants you to know you can handle the truth because you've got to. Harry Frankfurt, professor, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Frankfurt.
Harry Frankfurt, On Truth doesn't sound quite as zingy as On BS, but here you are out with it. What prompted you to bring out another one of these slim, pointed books on lies, truth, and BS, this time truth?
Well, I guess what prompted me to do it was that there was obviously a gap or a hole or an empty space in the previous book. As you said in your introduction, I argued there that indifference to the truth is a very serious problem. But I didn't explain why it's such a bad why it's such a serious problem. What's so important about caring about the truth? Why should we care about the truth? And what difference does it make if we do or don't?
Take us back to the core thesis of On BS, On Bull. You said there that BS is actually worse than lies because, as you say there, of the indifference to truth. At least liars, you said, care about the truth.
Yes, I suppose that any particular instance of BS may be less harmful or less damaging than an instance of lying, but the general tendency of BS, the prevalence and persistence of it, I think is very corrosive. It has an insidious, corrosive effect on the on society's conception of itself and of what it's all about and what its requirements are, because it breeds an indifference to the distinction between true and false, which lying doesn't do. The liar really cares about that distinction. He just wants to make sure that it's the false that gets around rather than the true. The BSer isn't really interested in whether what he says is true or false. He's interested in the effect that it will have on the people whom he's addressing. He's manipulating them, trying to bring about a certain change or alteration in their opinions and attitudes. And he will do that with whatever means are available, whether it's true or false.
So now you're back as a philosopher to remind us that truth really matters. Too much spin, too much truthiness, a kind of vague approximation of truth won't cut it. As a philosopher, what's your explanation? Why is it so important? There's a kind of obvious answer to that. Is it the same as the philosopher's?
I think basically it's the same. There's a fundamental truth about truth, which is that it has to do with our understanding of the nature of reality, and we need that very badly because that's where we live. We live in the real world, and we have to know something about it in order to manage our affairs in a prudent and effective way. So the philosopher begins with that common sense understanding and perhaps elaborates it in a more complex and precisely articulated way, but it's the same basic idea with which both common sense and philosophers begin.
There's the notion out there, and the fake news host Stephen Colbert has been kind of the promoter of this, the concept of truthiness, which has come into some currency, something less than truth, but very much in play. Here's Stephen Colbert, if you listen for a moment with us, Harry Frankfurt, Jack Beatty, explaining his concept of truthiness on the premiere episode of The Colbert Report, October 17, 2005.
Truthiness. Now, I'm sure some of the word police, the wordinistas over at Webster's, are going to say, hey, that's not a word. Well, anybody who knows me know that I'm no fan of dictionaries or reference books. They're elitist, constantly telling us what is or isn't true or what did or didn't happen. Who's Britannica to tell me the Panama Canal was finished in 1914? If I want to say it happened in 1941, that's my right. I don't trust books. They're all fact, no heart. And that's exactly what's pulling our country apart today. Because face it, folks, We are a divided nation. Not between Democrats and Republicans, or conservatives and liberals, or tops and bottoms. No. We are divided between those who think with their head and those who know with their heart.
Stephen Colbert, comedian. Harry Frankfurt, philosopher, is with us. His new book is On Truth. Is he on to something there? It's a laugh, but at the same time, what do you see, Harry Frankfurt? Have we as a society become less committed to truth itself, more comfortable with some approximation that suits our hearts?
Well, I don't know whether what we're looking for is something that suits our hearts, but we certainly have become less meticulous in our concern or demand or requirement of truth. We're prepared to accept, at least in a, with a kind of a, at most with a kind of a irritated shrug, all sorts of spin and BS and truthiness. And, you know, recently there have been a number of instances in which prominent writers and journalists have been discovered to have plagiarized their work. And although there's an encouraging response to that. I mean, we're not yet prepared to accept it as it's not regarded as acceptable, but it's becoming more and more prevalent. And as insofar as prominent and widely respected people indulge in it, I suppose in time it will become more acceptable than it is now. And that is a very it's a very bad thing. I don't know. It seems very obvious to me that insofar as people and society at large lose touch with reality, they're in trouble.
Jack Beatty, Harry Frankfurt came out and blew a big trumpet blast on BS, got everybody's attention, sold a lot of poignant, punchy little books. Now he's back to talk about truth. Does truth need defending these days, Jack?
I think it really does, and he does an excellent job in reminding us of just how unexpectedly important it is, including to our very identity as separate beings, as selves. But, you know, I'm struck more and more with this picture, Professor. If truth is a correspondence between thought and thing, then the medium, the connector between them is language. And it seems to me that that's where problems arise, that language can really play us false, that language comes encrusted with social weight, with conditioned circumstance, with the views that the powerful want us to hold. And I'm terribly afraid that in a world of such ubiquitous media, that language blocks us from the truth, that there's a kind of, to use Gramsci's terms, or the Italian Marxist, there's a cultural hegemony that of some ideas that steers us in the direction of one so-called truth and away from others. That, for example, in the case of the poor, even takes away any words they can use to explain their condition.
Harry Frankfurt, what do you say? Language making a kind of hegemony of one truth, but not necessarily the truth?
Language certainly has an important role in concealing or distorting or altering our understanding of the nature of reality. And that's what philosophers are about to a considerable extent, an attempt to clarify language, to make it more precise, and to eliminate, insofar as possible, the incrustation of cultural hegemony. And to protect people from the manipulative influences of those who have the control of the media and who are in charge of the promulgation of language and who therefore have a great deal of influence on how we speak and therefore on how we think.
Does that leave us with does it leave you with a concern about hegemony rather than truth? You know what Michael Foucault is saying, truth is a thing of this world produced only by multiple forms of constraint, and it includes regular effects of power. How do you account for the effects of power when you look at the truth? Is it all bent toward power, what we perceive as truth, or is there an absolute truth?
Well, I think there are frequently we're in a position to articulate and to recognize absolute truths, most obviously in the case of simple factual matters like the length of a piece of ground or the weight of an object or something that's measurable and the character of which can be determined with complete accuracy and confidence. I don't believe the truth is ever determined or established by social or cultural power. I think that sometimes beliefs are established that way. What people believe may be the result of the manipulative influence of social power. But that doesn't mean that the truth has been established in that way. That just means that people have been led to believe something that isn't true for the benefit of those who are in a position to influence their judgments by managing the language and encrusting our speech with, with a kind of a miasma of ideology.
We're talking this hour about the importance of truth in the age of truthiness and spin. My guest is Harry Frankfurt. He came out with On BS in 2005. Now he's out with a new book, On Truth. It's a slim, short, sweet, and to-the-point volume. Says it really matters. Civilization depends on it. Of course, there's the famous line where Tom Cruise cross-examines Jack Nicholson in the 1992 film A Few Good Men.
Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled to.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth! Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom.
Son, you can't handle the truth. Harry Frankfurt, T.S. Eliot quoted, I'm reading here recently, saying, humankind cannot bear very much reality. So do people really want truth, or do they want a cocoon of truthiness, as Colbert would have it?
I can't say exactly what people want, because I think it's a complicated matter which requires all kinds of qualifications and subtle distinctions. But I think it's true that, or I think it's correct, maybe I should avoid using the word true in this context, but I think it's correct to say that people are afraid of many truths. There are many areas in which they don't want to know the truth because it's too unsettling, too disturbing, too dangerous, too threatening to them, makes them too uncomfortable, makes them ashamed of themselves or worried about how they're going to manage. But I think that most people have a fairly deep awareness of how important the truth is when, and they are prepared to accept it, and they do want to know about it in circumstances where they're not personally threatened or personally liable to be personally damaged in some way by it. With respect, for example, to public affairs, which in most cases people are not threatened in the same way that they're threatened by truths about themselves, which might be very disturbing or difficult for them to accept. With respect to matters of public affairs, I think most people are aware of the importance of getting the straight story, of being told just what's going on, being having it explained to them what reality is and how the public officials concerned with it intend to deal with it and why there's reason to believe that that way of dealing with it would be effective. They don't want a lot of spin there. By the way, you've mentioned spin several times. That's a fairly new term. I think it's maybe about 20 years old or something like that. And I've wondered about just what does it mean? What do we mean when we talk about spin? I never got very far in my attempt to analyze that concept. But it did occur to me that there's an interesting difference between our talking about BS artists and our talking about spin doctors. Why is there reference to art in the one case and to medicine in the other? There are some clear explanations, I suppose, that go part of the way towards making it illuminating the situation. An artist makes things up; doesn't begin with anything except some raw material, perhaps. In the case of a literary artist, not even that, and a musical artist, not even that. It's a painter who has his paints, but most artists are just really starting from scratch, and they create something out of their own imaginations. The spin doctor, doctors don't do that. They repair things. They start with a situation which needs attention, and they bring to bear upon that some, hopefully, some medical experience and some medical expertise which enables them to cope with the situation in a way that is regarded as desirable and effective. So the doctor is concerned with repairing reality, where the artist is concerned with augmenting it, making something up, inventing it.
But maybe
that's as far as I got.
That's pretty good. Pretty good. But maybe difference. Both, given more running room in a time
when the idea of truth itself gets sort of fuzzed or mussed. I've got here a little tape of Donald Rumsfeld's famous known knowns speech. This was February 12th, 2002, expounding on the nature of truth at a Defense Department news briefing.
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Okay, Philosopher Frankfurt, is that BS spin or an obscure truth?
Well, I think he's right in what he was saying. There are these categories of belief and understanding and ignorance and doubt that he enumerated. And whatever you may think of Rumsfeld's general performance in public address, I think what he had to say on that occasion was quite right.
The philosopher's stamp of approval. Harry Frankfurt, Jack, I want to begin to bring our listeners in, if I may. Steve's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hello there. My question is regarding the dichotomy we have between subjective truth and objective truth. It sounds to me like Professor Frankfurt is comfortable with the ideology that truth equals fact. And the way I see it, that's a cultural hegemony of truth perpetrated by the language of science. So I think our notion of truth has been hijacked by scientific measurement. The professor said that his example of absolute truth was measurable, something that was measurable. And so that gives us the idea that truth, the more certain it is, the more truth it is, the more truthy it is. The more measurable it is, the more truthiness it is. And I think that's a form of BS.
Are you looking for a higher truth then, Steve, for spiritual truth? Or what do you hold that up in opposition to?
I'm looking for a less naive form of truth. The idea that truth equals facts, I think, is very naive. The idea that artists make things up out of scratch and cause that imagination, as opposed to real truth, which is fact, which is measurable, I think that's a very naive view. I think truth is something that's very hard to bear, and that fact is a very poor substitute for truth. And I think that people in this society are grasping for truth, but all they're getting is fact.
Steve, stick with us for a second, if you would. Harry Frankfurt, what do you say?
Well, I'm a little bit confused by the claim that whereas we're grasping for truth, all we're getting is fact. I'm not sure what's missing when we get all the facts that are relevant. What more do we want, or what else would be appropriate? I'm also confused by the notion that our notion of truth has been hijacked by science. I don't mind being hijacked by science. It seems to me that we'd all be much better off if we took more seriously the standards and requirements that science attempts to live by. The care and the caution that a scientist generally tries to manifest seems to me to be very useful and desirable characteristics.
Steve, what's missing in the realm of fact for you?
Oh, everything else. I mean, the whole realm of, for instance, love is not a fact. You can't prove, you can't measure love. You can't prove, you can't measure the realities of spiritual wisdom. Those are not measurable. Those are not provable. Those are not scientific entities. So we're missing. I mean, if we went by the realm of fact and science, we would end up in a world that's completely technologized. And I think we have too much of that already, and that our religion is now the religion of science.
Steve, let us run with that. And thanks for your call. Harry Frankfurt, maybe you would turn to Spinoza with us here. I mean, you make an argument about truth, joy, love, and a kind of thread that runs from one to the other.
Well, I can review Spinoza's views on that. He thought that love is essentially a response to a recognition of what makes us stronger, what makes us more ourselves, that enables us to realize our true natures and to conduct our lives in accordance with our true natures. So since we recognize that the truth, insofar as we recognize that the truth does enable us to live better, does enable us to live more authentically, does enable us to be ourselves, to find ourselves, and to realize our natures, we can't help loving the truth, because it's just what love is. It's a response to something that we recognize as helping us to achieve this kind of strength and providing us with the kind of joy that is associated with a recognition in ourselves that we have become stronger.
So truth to self-knowledge, that to joy, and joy to love. What do you say, Jack?
Well, I'm partial to the questions that Steve raises. I think they're fundamental, but here's my problem: deeper truth, truth that is not susceptible of factual verification, can be isolating. It is not a place where people can meet. It becomes this group's truth and that group's truth. And that really, it seems to me, is one of the things that religion does. It says these are truths over here, and these are the things you should pay attention to. But I believe that it inculcates habits of mind that leak into the public realm, where we all should share the same truth, and that it leaks into the public realm in this way. People begin to say, well, that's my opinion. They put belief first, before facts. I mean, Daniel Moynihan said it very well. He said people are entitled to their own opinions, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And I think more and more that as this higher kind of truth, this faith truth, this belief truth, leaks into the public realm, well, then you have, you know, claims such as Mr. Bush's all the time that, you know, I feel this in my gut. This is something I feel. This is something I believe.
But, Jack, isn't some of that necessary, kind of lubricant, and maybe even to lift up humans? I mean, is reality or truth just a pile of facts? Do they add up to enough? You say it goes deeper, but is there no room for a transcendent truth?
Can I intervene here?
Please, yeah.
Let the philosopher handle that one. Save us. Yes, please.
Let me see. What was I trying to say? First of all, let me respond to something that Steve said.
Yes.
He enumerated a number of items that he regarded as outside the realm of truth or the realm of fact, and one of them was love, for example. We have to be careful about that. The fact that A loves B is a fact. That there's a truth about that, just as there's a truth about the sun rising in the morning. It is a fact that A loves B, and it's true to say that A loves B. Now, the nature of love, the character of it, may be more difficult to understand, and it may not be susceptible to the kind of measurement that we find in the advanced sciences. But that's another matter. That doesn't mean that love is outside the realm of truth or outside the realm of fact. It is a fact. It's just a fact of a kind that requires understanding in a particular way. I'd like to go back to the point that led me to want to intervene in the first place, but I can't remember now what it was.
Well, the point that was raised, that Jack's saying, transcendent truth or religious truth may be, Jack, if I'm interpreting you right, may be an enemy of the kind of truth you're describing, Harry Frankfurt. What do you say, Mr. Philosopher?
Well, I don't know whether it should be an enemy. Maybe it has been an enemy characteristically over the course of the centuries, but a genuine religion ought to be able to face reality. In fact, I think the whole point of religion is to help us to face reality. And therefore, it should be based upon facts. It should be based upon truths. It may not be the kind of fact that an engineer is concerned with. It may be more the kind of fact that a psychologist or an artist is concerned with. But it needs to be grounded in the truth. Otherwise, it will be ephemeral. It will evaporate. People won't be able to hang on to it. It will be blown away by the experience, by reality, the reality that people actually face.
But is there room for a higher truth then? Let me go to Tom in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, I believe there is a higher form of truth. I am a Christian, and as I'm listening to the discussion, I'm jotting down what I think are the valuable forms of truth, and I think that there are three. There are facts, there are meaning, like the deeper forms of truth that one of your guests was talking about, and then there are consensus. This is a political kind of truth. That's based on fact, and there's consensus that's based on lies that's not so valuable. And there's spin, which is not valuable, but it's kind of a distortion of meaning, a deliberate distortion of meaning. But it's very important to bring meaning to the public square, as it is to bring meaning to anything that we do in terms of finding the truth, because you know, it gives meaning to our lives. You can't have meaning to your lives just based on facts, and you can't have it based on just consensus.
Do you share or not then, Tom, Jack Beatty's concern that a reference to a higher truth can sort of short-circuit the fact part of this and insert anything?
It can if you don't distinguish between these valuable forms of truth. As long as you're distinguishing between facts and meaning, then you're okay. But if you lose that distinction, then you may have that distortion.
Tom, I'm sure it's wonderful. There is an important distinction to be made between facts and meaning, but if I can just make a simple observation, what has meaning for us depends a lot upon what we are like, depends upon what we want, what we are capable of, what we are striving for, what our yearnings are. And those are factual matters. A person has to understand himself in order to find meaning in his life. And he has to have a genuine, a true, a correct understanding of himself. He has to have an understanding of himself that corresponds to the facts about himself. There's no escape from reality into another realm of understanding. All forms of understanding rest and require a reference to facts and to truth as commonly understood.
Jack Beatty?
There's one more thing I'd like to say.
Please.
I remember now what I was trying to say when I intervened a while ago. Somebody made reference to gut feelings. I'm not against gut feelings. I think sometimes they're very important, and relying on gut feelings may be the most sensible thing to do. But a person's gut feelings are only as valuable as the experience to which they, which has led to them. It's only because a person has had a lot of experience of the sort of problem with which he's confronted that he, only because he has acquired a great deal of information about it, because he understands it, because he knows the truth about it, that his gut feelings about it are worth anything. Mm. Gut feelings of an ignorant person aren't worth a thing.
Jack, our caller Tom in Nashville, points to religion as a potentially a receptacle for meaning and consensus for that sort of hierarchy of truth. Are you willing to go with that?
Well, it certainly is. It certainly is the case that it does that. I think we are meaning-making creatures, but. What worries me there, again, is does our meaning-making often come at the expense of recognizing the world where someone else has different meanings? In other words, even Muslims and Christians disagree about the meaning machinery, but they can agree that the sun rises in the same place and that, you know, in other words, the common world can join people who even disagree as to meaning. What I'm afraid of and what I think happens more and more is that the meaning-making machinery dips into the world and denies its commonality or sort of occludes it.
We're talking this hour about the importance of truth in the age of truthiness and spin. Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show, interviewed Harry Frankfurt just last Tuesday.
Haven't we benefited greatly from a lack of truth?
Absolutely. And we continue to do so. Well, we're not benefiting so much right now, but we...
Ebbs and flows.
It comes and goes, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We're in a downstretch.
I suppose you could say so.
Does truth pull you out of a morass, you the opportunity to more?
It may get you into a morass. Truth is very difficult to cope with because reality is difficult to cope with. You get that?
You just blew my mind, brother.
There's the comedy side of the question of truth, but it gets deadly serious as well. Everybody heard the exchange just last week of Senator Chuck Hagel, Nebraska Republican, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. The senator interrupted her to say she's not telling the truth at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Thursday.
Your intelligence and mine is a lot different, and I know my time is up here. But to sit there and say that, Madam Secretary, that's just not true.
Well, Senator,
that is not true.
Senator, if you allow me to finish, I think there is a point I'd like to make about the Iraqis killing Iraqis and what that really is.
Well, what that really is pretty obvious. What really is.
That's just not true, said the senator. And for some reason, it sounded pretty refreshing just to hear that phrase. Let me take a call from Elizabeth in Canton, New York. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. I really enjoy your show, and this is a fascinating discussion that's really turning my mind. Anyway, I guess I'm thinking of truth in the context of interaction between people and state.
Okay.
And let's just say that we define truth, then, as telling people what and why... you know, the people in power are doing what they're doing. And I realize that this is sort of excludes a more complex existential, you know, definition of the nature of truth itself. But...
Are you saying truth is a weapon of the state, or is it a weapon of the people against the state?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of it as just sort of the nature of interaction between state and people. And just looking back through history... I'm trying to think of any examples where there hasn't been a blurring of what is right and wrong or true and false in order to benefit the agenda of those in power. And perhaps in our own country's short history, even, I really can't think of a time when there was actual, you know, straight talk between the people in power and, you know, the people that they're, supposedly leading. And I just feel like, as horrible as it is, I wonder if really a government could tell people the truth, because it seems like it would alienate a dangerous portion of the population. You know what I mean?
It's a big question. Let me put it to Harry Frankfurt. Philosopher Frankfurt, what do you say? Power and truth.
Well, I think that Elizabeth has a very important point. It's a point I think that I tried to make, although I only glanced at it very briefly in my first book, the book on BS, in which I suggested that part of the explanation for the persistence and prevalence of BS in our culture is that we live in a society which depends upon the will of the people. The government can't act by itself. Ultimately, it really requires the cooperation or at least the consent, the assent of the population. And therefore, it's very important for the government that the population should, on the whole, approve of what it's doing. And so they will almost inevitably be in a manipulative situation where it's important for them to mold, shape, and manipulate public opinion in ways that are favorable to the interests of government. And I think that's true of all governments. Perhaps it was less true in the past when there were governments that didn't depend so heavily upon the approval or the assent of the population, monarchies or other forms of government in which public opinion was less had less importance. Although I think even in those situations it does have importance. Even a tyranny, even a totalitarian government requires obedience. It requires that the people are prepared to go along with what's happening without rebelling. So governments are almost inevitably tempted. Tempted is too weak a term. They're almost inevitably required to manipulate public opinion, and insofar as the manipulation requires a distortion of the facts, they will distort the facts, not to mention the fact that they themselves often don't know the truth about things. So it's not that they are concealing or withholding the truth. It's that they are just as confused as the people are about what's going on.
Jack, Elizabeth raises the question. The founders had their own kind of skepticism here. Thomas Jefferson said, "It is error alone which needs the support of government. Truth can stand by itself." What say ye, Jack?
Well, I think she really does raise a very important point, and so does the professor. But paradoxically, you seem to be suggesting, Professor, that democracy is more liable to governments manipulating truth, than say, an absolute regime that doesn't need to worry about that. And I say that's paradoxical because one of the justifications of democracy is that it's self-corrective. That that the people can correct the government, that policies are corrigible by public experience. People can look and see, well, that failed and this failed. We must change. And you're suggesting that it's more complicated.
I think it is more complicated, and I accept the paradox that you suggested in what you just said. Democracies, I think, are more susceptible to manipulative governments than, at least with respect to public opinion, than other forms of government are. But I think that it's also correct to say that democracies have within themselves the energy, the potential energy at least, to get rid of the lying or the distorting or the spinning or BSing government, and that from time to time people get fed up with it and rise up and turn the rascals out. Part of the problem is that many of the issues that are of greatest urgency to a democratic country nowadays, our country in particular, have to do with foreign matters involving foreign affairs with respect to which people have themselves practically no experience. They know when they're not getting enough to eat. They know when they're not earning enough to live a comfortable life. They know that sort of thing from their own personal experience. But they don't really know what's going on in the international realm or what the significance and meaning of various things that are happening there, treaties and conflicts and so forth. It's very difficult to understand those things. And the population at large is at a great disadvantage in attempting to form responsible opinions with regard to them, especially because the government is not particularly interested in helping them do so.
So harder for the BS meter to kick in, but we're watching and listening and learning. George Colling is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi to all of you. I have a quotation for you and a question.
Yeah.
The quotation is from Nietzsche, who says, "Convictions are more dangerous foes of truth than lies." Now, here's my question. If someone is convinced that he is right, how do you persuade him of the truth, assuming he doesn't have the truth? And as one of your earlier callers suggested, it may not be enough merely to present the facts.
Harry Frankfurt, this sounds right up your alley, your line of work.
Well, how you persuade somebody who's convinced of something to give up his conviction is a very difficult problem. If you eliminate the alternative of presenting him with rational arguments and concrete evidence that he's mistaken and in favor of some other position, if that's not the solution of the problem, then I don't know what else you can do. You can laugh at him. You can make him embarrassed. You can make him feel ashamed of himself. You can show him that most people think he's ridiculous. You can hit him over the head. There are all sorts of ways of getting people to change their opinions, but none of them is a very good way except the way of illumination, of showing them that they are wrong and showing them how to achieve a more accurate account of things.
But this whole book on truth seems to me to be just the kind of argument you'd make to such a person. I mean, you say a society, civilization cannot last without standing on truth. So but, you know, everything hinges on it.
Yes, but we're not talking about a man who denies the importance of truth. We're talking about a man who is convinced of things that are mistaken. And conviction is not an enemy of civilization as such, although I suppose that fanatical conviction, stubborn conviction, a conviction that includes a refusal to face reality, that is a dangerous matter.
Let me go to Kelly in Suffolk, Virginia. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
There was another adage that I'd like to add to the conversation, and I saw it on a school teacher's door years ago, and I've never forgotten it. And it said, the difference between knowledge and truth is that one is constantly changing and the other one always remains the same. It is disastrous to confuse the two. And feeling or really integrating that makes me believe that I really don't know if I have any truth at all, or if everything that I believe is really knowledge or my reality of any given situation. The panel discussed, you know, we can all agree on the sun rising and setting in the same place, and that's how quick we set up a falsity. The sun is not moving, and if you sit and watch a sunset, and if we had the circumference of the earth and the old rate times time equals distance, we're doing a backflip at however many tens of thousands of miles per hour, and at the same time, spinning around the sun.
Kelly, let me ask you then. You've got Harry Frankfurt here, professor of philosophy emeritus, 77 years old, a lot of study of this. Are you looking for consolation from this philosopher if you're not sure you can find truth anywhere, or are you saying to him his pursuit of it is misguided?
No, I think any philosophical or Socratic inquiry is important. It's important for us to fine-tune our own truth in the discussion, and I think we need to stand in our own truth and not pass judgment on others because, you know, for instance, I've been a mother for 18 years.
Mm.
I just sent my son off to college. You would think I would know what to do, but I've never done this before. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
We never step into the same river twice. And when my youngest goes off in 6 years, I will never have done that before because she offers a different variable.
Kelly, stand by. Harry Frankfurt, there's the phrase, our own truth. We each have our own truth, Kelly says. Are you willing to go with that, doctor of philosophy?
Well, I think that in a certain sense, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to say that we each have our own truth. We each occupy a particular position in the world, and we each have our own particular perspective on the world. Therefore, things look different to us from our perspective than they do to somebody who's standing somewhere else and looking at things from a different direction or at a different distance. So there's no question that our experience which is the basis of our beliefs and the basis of whatever truth we have, our experience differs. Experience of one person differs from experience of another, and therefore the truths that one person has available to him will differ from those available to the other. But that doesn't mean that either of those people is lacking the truth, or that one truth is better than the other, or one is superior or dominant over the other. If something looks big to you and small to me, we may both be right, because you're standing close to it and I'm standing far away. So it looks big to you and it looks small to me. And those are both facts, and we can understand why they are facts, and we can understand how there's no real conflict between them, even though there seems to be a difference. Mm.
Kelly, thanks for calling. Harry Frankfurt, I wanted to ask you something at a personal level. You said in a recent interview, I saw this in the Times, that people in this country are starved for the truth, you said. But I wonder if you found different levels of appetite for the truth, and if it relates to our own personal history. You also noted there that when you were 36 years old, your mother told you that you were adopted. Now here you are with these kind of very best-selling treatises on BS and truth. Is it personal experience in yours and ours in general which disposes us to different degrees of appetite for truth, do you think?
I'm sure that is at least a large part of the explanation. In my book on truth, I suggested that my own appetite for truth was stimulated by experience I had as a child, where I had the idea that a lot of people were trying to foist ridiculous ideas on me, and that the only protection I had against that kind of assault on my consciousness was to find out what the truth really was about the matters that were at issue. And so I became very devoted to an attempt to find the truth. I want to say something about the caller's remark, because I think that the skepticism that she expressed is a very healthy thing. Being uncertain that you yourself have the truth is quite compatible with believing that there is such a thing as truth, and that it doesn't depend upon you, that it's independent of what you think. And I think it's desirable that everybody should be cautious and skeptical about their own convictions, their own beliefs, and be open to the idea that maybe they're wrong, that maybe the truth is not what they think it is, but something else entirely. So her complaint, or her, I don't know if it was a complaint, but her statement that she doesn't know if she knows any truths, that's fine. Socrates had the same attitude toward himself, that he didn't really know anything. And the Delphic Oracle declared that he was therefore the wisest man in Greece, because at least he was aware that he didn't know anything, was prepared to admit it.
And yet, Jack, we've just got half a minute here. Harry Frankfurt writes, a slovenly indifference to the distinction between true and false will leave a society in big trouble.
Yes, it will. And here's where science, which you know, our Steve earlier reminded us, can be too factual based and too limited. But here's where it's important, not as a body of knowledge or facts, but as a procedure. Science deals with verification, and that habit of truth, it seems to me, is one of the things we can carry away from it. And that will help us as a society distinguish between statements that are accurate, made by public officials, and statements that are not, between truth as conviction and truth as something, as a correspondence between all minds and the world. So I think the habit of truth in science is very, very valuable.
And a correspondence between all minds. It's a good phrase to go out on. Harry Frankfurt, author of On BS and now On Truth, thanks very much for being with us today. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, great as always to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I found the greatest joy of my salvation is knowing that my children walk in truth.